with the police banging on the door. Open up.
The choice to be in that lineup was the last choice I made as a free man.
A year later, I ended up right in the system.
I'm going to be one of those people who everyone in the world is going to think is a monster or suspect is a monster for the rest of my life, and I'm just going to have to come to peace with that.
Somebody was able to look at my picture in a database and say that I was somewhere where I definitely wasn't.
I overheard three of the jailers discussing what part they might have to play in my hanging. They had been told that two prison officers would have to participate in my execution.
And I walked back inside that prison for the last time, man. All hell broke loose, man.
Welcome to another episode of Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. This is part two of the San Diego series, where we'll be doing shorter interviews than usual because we have so many incredible people here at the Innocence Network Conference. Today, I'll be interviewing Christine Bunch and Obi Anthony.
The tragedy for Christine Bunch began in 1995 when a fire in this Greensburg mobile home killed her three-year-old son.
The mother, who spent nearly 17 years in prison for arson and murder, after state fire investigators hid evidence that could have cleared her.
Christine Bunch has maintained her innocence all along.
Years of anguish for a crime she says she did not commit, now over.
All charges were eventually dropped against Christine Bunch after the original report surfaced.
An Indiana mother who spent 16 years in prison in the killing of her young son is free tonight after charges against her are dropped.
Christine, welcome.
Thank you.
We are in the sunshine in San Diego, where we are broadcasting from the Innocence Network Conference, which is a conference where we bring together, this year I think we have 200 exonerees.
Yes, we do.
With people from the movement, social workers, attorneys, counselors, teachers.
Law students,
press. It's the amount of positive energy that's being generated here this weekend is remarkable, wouldn't you say?
It's incredible. And you can feel the buzz.
And you are right in the middle of it. I don't know, your energy is so incredible. So Christine was wrongfully convicted in one of the worst possible scenarios, which is that she lost her child. Her three-year-old son, Anthony, was killed in a fire in your home. And we know now, and I think they knew then, that the arson science is not really science. Not only did they know that, but also they really knew that this was not arson. Why they felt they wanted to go after you in the way they did, I don't know that we'll ever understand, because it's like trying to understand evil. But one way or another, you were wrongfully convicted. And this Innocence Network Conference is about overcoming and triumphing, and you are certainly a great example of that. First, let's go back to that awful time and just give the audience a sense of what was going on. You were very young at the time, right?
I was 21 and a single mother working, going to school, and I had my three-year-old. And so my life was just busy and full. And one morning I woke up and was surprised because I thought it was foggy in the house. And in truth, it was on fire. And it takes a minute for your brain to realize what's happening, what you're doing in that moment, because you're just frozen with fear. And it's like your mind goes blank. And then it's like you're running through mud trying to figure out, what do I do? And I'm throwing things on it. Because you always hear in school, smother it. But we don't realize that the materials we use now are synthetics and they just melt. They don't smother it. It's burning in your hands. So I ran out the door to get help and fed the fire. When I went out, oxygen came in and made it even bigger. But you're just panicked, thinking, I've got to get in there. I've got to do something. So then I broke a window with his tricycle and tried to climb in. And by that time, the flames were coming through the roof. They took me to the hospital. And of course, I'm asking, did you find him? Because I couldn't find him. It never occurred to me that he wasn't coming out alive. And that simple statement was used against me at my trial because I asked, did you find him? Like they said, I knew he was already dead. But you just don't think that things will happen to you like that.
There's nothing in the phrase, did you find him, that says to me, did you find a dead body? I mean,
exactly.
They twist these things in so many ways, and it's so weird, too. I mean, we see over and over again in wrongful conviction cases, especially cases like yours, where they say, well, you didn't react the way we think you should have.
Yes.
You were too upset. You weren't upset enough. I mean, how is anyone supposed to know how you're going to react? Everyone reacts differently in all types of panic situations, right? This is beyond panic. This is terror.
This is
sheer terror. You've almost lost your life. You're in the process of losing your son, you don't even know, and your home, and you just woke up.
Yes.
I mean, add that to everything. Most people, they just wake up. They don't even know what to do. They stumble around looking for the coffee machine, right?
Right.
I mean, here you are just waking up, and the house is on fire. And everything that you're trying to do to help is backfiring, right?
Exactly.
Because who the hell would know, right? I mean, they teach us a little bit in school, right? Throw a thing on it. But, I mean, it's not like you took fire training. You weren't a volunteer firefighter or anything like that, right?
No.
So now the sort of witch hunt or whatever you want to call it starts. They decide that this is something they want to pursue. They're going to get this mom. You go to trial. Did you think that you were going to be vindicated? Did you think that it was curtains? I mean, they had these arson investigators and all these supposed experts saying all this stuff about these accelerants, which we now know not only isn't a real science, but also wasn't true. But
exactly.
What were you thinking? I mean, you're just a kid in Decatur, Indiana, right?
Right. I mean, you're always taught the police are your friends. They're going to find out the truth. You know, they would never do anything wrong. So I went to court thinking, I'm going to go home. They're going to see the truth. They're going to see that I didn't do this. And then when they said guilty, I was just in shock. I just blanked. And everybody's trying to ask me questions on the way out, going to the police station. And I mean, I'm still registering what they just said to me, let alone trying to answer your question. So I'm just looking at them and it's just a blur.
Right. And this is, Christine, this is what we see on TV all the time, right? The people that sit at the cameras, the reporters yelling.
Yes.
And now they're all part of this mob mentality, right? You're stuck in a nightmare that would be unimaginable to anyone who hasn't been through it. Then you're sent to prison. Sentenced to?
I was sentenced to 60 years for murder, 50 for arson, and they ran them concurrently. So it was just the 60 years.
Just 60?
Just 60.
Right, and you were 21, so
yes.
At 81 you would have come out on your walker, and maybe.
Maybe.
If you were paroled. So you go to prison.
I go to prison.
And now you're pregnant.
I am pregnant. I was released on bond when it came back. The test results came back that it wasn't gasoline, because they thought I'd used gasoline to set the fire. So when those results came back negative for gasoline, my judge put me out on bond.
That would have seemed like an appropriate time to drop the charges, but they decided to put you out on bond.
They put me out on bond, and I feel like it wasn't the best thing, but the best thing came out of it. Because when I came out, I was doing all the wrong things. I was taking whatever anybody gave me. I was drinking. I honestly didn't care if I woke up. I'd lost everything. I mean, finding out I was pregnant with Tony changed my life, and I changed my life to take care of my son and give him everything that I could give him. And when I lost him, I didn't want to live. I wanted to be numb. I didn't want to feel. And so I was very reckless. And I met a guy and spent some time with him, and he was feeding me whatever I wanted to be numb. And then I started getting really sick and found out that I was pregnant, and I didn't think that I could have any more. So that was kind of my miracle moment. And I changed everything and started focusing on fighting, because I had a son to fight for. I had something to live for at that moment.
And this is a really, I think, interesting part of the story, in that you gave birth in prison.
Yes.
And as we spoke about before, there's different protocols in different places in the country, in the world. There's no good answer for how do you deal with a baby in prison. And having a child yanked away, whether it's on 24 hours in, as what happened to you, or 3 years later, like those that last period of time, like counting down the minutes or the seconds, I can't even imagine. It's just so horrible. But in Indiana, their policy was 24 hours and then kiss the kid goodbye.
Yes, you're going back to the facility.
And the baby's going home.
Yeah, my family took my son and they had him right over to the prison because I passed them on my way back out to be transferred to the facility. And both of us weren't supposed to be released until the next day. So I passed my dad and I'm sobbing and telling him, don't leave my baby here. I can't lose another baby. You got to get my baby. So the doctor that actually delivered him helped my family to get a car seat and blankets so they could take him right then because they had everything for the next day. And then he brought him straight over to the prison so that I would know that they had him and I didn't have to worry.
That was at least a small blessing that you were able to have family and know that your baby son was going to be taken care of and protected and loved. And you got to have visitation with him 10 hours a month? Was that how it worked out?
You get 10 hours a month in the regular visiting room, where you can't really do anything. You have to be sitting in a chair so I could hold him on my lap. But it took a while for us to change the policy where I could get on the floor and do blocks with him on the table or cars. But when I first got there, you sat in the chair. Your family went and got chips or a Coke for you. You couldn't move. And if he needed something like his diaper changed or to be fed, my family would have to get up and go out into the outer corridor and take care of that there. That couldn't be done in the visiting room. So I didn't really have any hands-on until 6 months in when they opened the family preservation program and our children could come in for one-on-one visits with us. And so then I got an extra 10 hours a month just for him.
Yeah, that's something I want to highlight is that these programs in the prisons that provide a little glimpse of humanity in an otherwise cold and cruel and purely punitive system that we have here is so important. And in your case, I can see you lighting up talking about it. I mean, what a difference that makes, you know? So, and obviously what a difference it did make. And so ultimately, your case was overturned.
It was.
16 years later.
Yes.
Let's just talk for a moment about what that was like. Vindication, freedom.
I mean, just the new evidence that came out in the case. You know, my son reached an 80% carbon monoxide level. That was new fire science from a forensic toxicologist. And hearing her say that I was in the very next room and was probably half of that level, and hallucinating, everything's blurry, everything's slow, you're sluggish. I mean, that made me feel better because you always think you can do more. And then finding out they falsified an ATF report. That right there, that was vindication for me. If I'd have never walked out, at least I knew that it wasn't an arson. He wasn't murdered. It was just an accident, and that, I think, was the best moment. Walking out was good, but it's scary.
And I want to talk about that. And the Center for Wrongful Convictions played a big role in your exoneration, so I want to give them respect and appreciation.
Yes, they did.
From both of us, because without them, you wouldn't be here.
No.
And your advocate was Betsy Marks, right, as well?
Yes.
So there's a number of heroes in this situation.
Yes, there is.
And ultimately, you walked out. And that's what I really want to focus on, because we're here at the Innocence Network Conference. And watching people heal and recover and transform themselves is such a powerful thing. Every time I see it, it just makes me want to do more and more and everything I can to help and promote this work. So when you get out, then what? 16 years, a long time.
Yes, very long time.
So what were the things? Like, where did you go? How did you reconnect? And what could we as a society do differently to help others who are coming out after this type of ordeal?
I think it's important for people to know that you don't have to give a whole lot out of your wallet to make a difference for us. If we just had people that would give us time, I mean, I didn't know, and it was like the most embarrassing thing for me. I'm 39 years old. It took me 10 minutes to get out of the bathroom because they had removed the knobs on the water faucets. And I didn't know how to turn it on. I just thankfully finally flicked something.
So you had the automatic.
Yes.
Right. And it's a so weird thing. I still have trouble with that.
It came on and I was like, oh my God. And I'm in tears by the time I come out. And there's my brother saying, what's wrong? Are you sick? Is there a problem? I said, I didn't know how to turn on the water. And so things like that make me want to stay at home because I don't want to go out and be embarrassed and tell people, I don't know how to do this. I was waiting for a full service gas station and we don't have those anymore. So things that I've never learned how to do, like change my oil or check my tire pressure, I now have to go find somebody to do that because I can't just pull up and say, fill it up and can you check everything?
Do you remember what time you were actually released?
I want to say it's 4 or 5 in the afternoon.
And what did you do? Where'd you go?
So first we went, I didn't talk to any of those reporters that called me a baby killer. And I gave one interview with Sandra Chapman because she had interviewed me in the prison and helped push my case forward. So she was the only exclusive that I gave. And we went to a park and I got to walk in the grass barefoot. And we had a nice time there. And then we went over to Bistro 310. And I had champagne with my attorneys, and they made me some scallops because seafood was my favorite. They asked what kind of food I wanted. I said, colorful. And she said, what do you mean? And I said, everything in there is kind of brown and gray, and it's just not pretty. I said, I want to eat vegetables that are colored and nice and cheese and different kinds of things. So they set me up with hummus and pita and
hummus is the same color. What do you mean?
Not all of it. There was a spicy that was kind of red. And
I would have gotten a strawberry or maybe like a...
I had that for dessert. I had a whole plate of different fruits and cream cheese dip and then whipped cream. It was incredible.
Yeah, that sounds incredible. And then you went where?
Then I went to my mother's house where my son was staying. And I was up most of the night because I had never gotten to see my baby sleep.
That's an incredible visual, and I see you tearing up. I mean, I'm trying not to myself. And now you watch him sleep, you get up the next day. Is it starting to feel real at that point?
It's feeling real. It's also feeling frightening. I mean, the only thing I have is my prison uniform and my white tennis shoes in a bag. I had no clothes. I have no hygiene. I don't have a toothbrush. And I'm thinking, I have no money. How am I supposed to get these things? I have no vehicle. How am I supposed to get around? And thank goodness, 3 o'clock in the afternoon when my brother got off of work, he came and picked me up and we went out to eat. And I literally, again, had no idea what to order. Decisions are so real hard because for so long, I haven't made any. And I'm trying to branch out and get better with that, but it's still an issue that I go through. So we ate, and I had a peach frozen margarita and a steak. And then he took me shopping. And so we went into this clothing store, and there's all these colors. And he's like, what do you want? Well, I've had nothing but white and khaki. I have no idea. And so my eyes bug out, and he was like, okay. He said, you go in the fitting room. I'm going to bring you outfits. So he brought me back outfits and the things that I put on and said, this fits good and I like this. They went into the keep pile and everything else went back. And then when we left there, he took me to an old-fashioned candy store and got me some candy that we had when we were kids. And then we went to a wine store and I tasted some wine and he picked up a couple bottles of that. And then we went to Walmart, and at that point, I'm like, wow, I'm over the moon with everything I'm seeing, and Walmart's now a super Walmart. And we go to pick out shampoo, and he's like, what do you want? Well, I've only had two choices, and there's a whole aisle. I have no idea. So here's my brother, and we're smelling them up and down the aisle. He said, we'll just pick what smells good. So we went through, and we found something that I liked, and So by the time we get through there and I'm like, you know, I need some feminine products, there's a whole aisle of that. And he's like, what do you want? Well, I've only had one in 16 years and I don't know. And at this point, I'm done. I'm wiped out. I can't speak. And here I start crying. And so he looks at me and he was like, it's okay. He said, my wife uses this, and he puts it in the cart. And he said, and if you don't like it, he said, we'll come back every day until we find what works for you. And so he took me to his house and I had wine and he made me homemade guacamole and I sat and visited with him. Yes, it's colorful. And then I ended up spending the night with him. And then the next day is when he took me to the movie theater and I couldn't turn on the water. So he made it good. And he's the one that, between him and my son, they kept me going out instead of hiding in the house and not dealing with people. And they helped me get my license. I had to have a learner's permit again. They taught me how to build up my credits, how to use the internet, social media.
Awesome. What is your social media? Do you want to plug it on the podcast? Do you want more people to follow you, or are you more of a private kind of person?
No, I mean, people can follow me. I'm on Twitter.
Yeah, what's
Christine Bunch.
Christine Bunch, KristineBunch on Twitter.
Yes.
And I do want to talk about your organization.
Okay.
Justice for Just Us.
Yes.
You had a wonderful support group, which was your family, but many people have nothing.
Exactly.
People are in for 30 years. They come out, they've got nobody left. It's a catchy name, Justice for Just Us. What's Just Us?
Just Us is, it's a combination. I have Juan Rivera, who's another exoneree. He spent 21 years, and he is in Illinois. I'm in Indiana, and we decided we wanted to do something because people come out and they have no one. You spend 40 years in there. Most of your family's probably died. And there's no one to meet you. There's no one to take you out shopping and do the things that my brother did. So we decided that it was up to us to bring justice to other exonerees. So we're getting ready to put in for our non-for-profit. That'll probably go in a couple weeks. And our hope is that we can continue to train and hire other exonerees in their states and just make our community aware of what people need when they walk out, how they can help. Everybody can help. If you have a barber shop, give an exoneree a haircut. If you have a clothing shop, give them a new outfit so they can go get do an interview. So we hope that we can just keep educating through our speaking events and bring people in to help. And even if you give a gift card of $20, that's a shirt for someone.
Sure.
That's something easy. You don't have to donate thousands of dollars to make a difference, just taking someone on the bus.
Many people listening probably saying, well, but I don't know how to find that person. So, I mean, would you recommend they go to an Innocence Project website, maybe a local Innocence Project website, or because there's Innocence Projects all around the country?
Absolutely. You can go to any of the Innocence Project's websites and find ways that you can volunteer and help with our exonerees. Our Facebook page is Just Is IS 4, and it's the number Just Us.
Okay, so it's Just Is, JUSTIS, the number 4, Just Us. On Facebook.
Oh, we also have a website under that name as well.
Okay, good. So get involved. Christine Bunch has been our wonderful, amazing guest today.
Thank you.
You can't see her smile, but she has a magnetic smile. And if you were here with me, you would absolutely want to give her a hug, which is exactly what I'm going to do as soon as we get off the air. So thank you, Christine, again for being here and for sharing your experience, strength, and hope. And now let's get right into it with the one and only Obi Anthony.
Anthony and Cole were convicted 20 years ago of a shooting death in South L.A.
Back in 1994, Anthony's legal team says a pimp pointed a finger at the two men.
They were released 4 years ago after a key witness recanted his testimony.
The pimp later recanted his story.
Their lawyers then found out an L.A. Times reporter had taken home shell casings from the murder scene that could have pointed to another suspect.
Prosecutors and police refused to admit that they did anything wrong.
In this case, there was not one piece of physical evidence, and that's the key. That's what the police did wrong in this case. They ignored the evidence of innocence and twisted the evidence to point towards guilt because they wanted to clear a case.
The two detectives that helped put Obi Anthony and his co-defendant behind bars, one still works for the LAPD.
According to Obi Anthony's lawyers and the judge that exonerated him, evidence showed they were never here the night of the killing.
Obi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You were sentenced to life in prison.
Life without the possibility of parole.
Yeah, correct. Life like the no joke version of life. Yeah, like not some life like we're like kind of kidding and we'll
like
you...
the one that you know, we're not even talking about talking to you forever. Like it's no parole.
And you were framed.
I was actually framed by the detective Marcella Wynn. They had information from the very onset that me and my co-defendant at the time, Reggie Cole, wasn't involved. It was her plus. It was her win on that end of the bargain because she has, in the law, in the eyes of her co-workers, a successful incarceration, and now is just pending a conviction. So it was her who actually framed me.
And how did it come to be that you even became a suspect in this? Because it's funny looking at you now. I mean, you can't see him on the radio, but he's a very dapper individual, very good-looking gentleman, you know?
Yeah, thank you.
He's got his here at the conference where everybody's kind of casual. He's got the tie and the vest and the sharp-looking shirt and everything. So, I mean, how did you get wrapped up in this nightmare? I mean, what was it like for you? You were just a young man trying to make it in the world.
You know, I don't want to mislead your listeners. I grew up in the inner city of Los Angeles, California, South Central. I was involved in gangs. But what actually got me involved in this case here that got me wrongfully convicted was because they allegedly got an anonymous call saying that a guy made a bad move on 49th Street and hung up the phone. From that phone call, the young lady, Marcella Wynn, the caller gave a name of Baby Day. She said that she ran the name Baby Day through the gang database, and she had hits with the name Baby Day, but it was multiple hits. And she determined that the Baby Day that she was looking for was a guy named Michael Miller out of all of those Baby Days. And then come to find out, he was incarcerated at that time with me. And so that's how they got their hands on my picture.
Well, and this was 1994, and it was a very violent time.
Yes.
And they were interested in processing these cases and closing them.
Yeah,
right?
Correct. And at that time, you had a news reporter by the name of Miles Corwin, who was acting as a follow-along reporter with the LAPD at that time. And that's what he was writing and reporting on in 1994, was the gang violence in South Central Los Angeles and a murder rate in which the homicide division, in other words, their cases and what they had. And so he had the privilege at that point to ride along with Marcella Wynn and Pete Resiskins, the detective that was involved in my homicide case, which turned out to be a plus. Because that reporter reported what he's seen as he's seen it, while those investigative detectives that work for the police department left out all of the pertinent information, which was pertinent to prove my innocence. So it was amazing.
Unfortunately, it is common.
Yes.
I mean, common, I'm trying to even find the right word for it. It's like, it's pervasive, this kind of behavior. Among the
people.
It's
criminal. I'll call it criminal.
It is criminal. It's criminal as it is common, unfortunately. And the fact is that it's hard for people to understand why and how it goes so wrong when the people who we pay to protect us, that's protect and serve, right?
Correct.
Go on this rogue mission. And I know, you know, they say power corrupts and absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. Right. And I think they become desensitized to a certain extent when they're dealing with one case after another. And it starts to become like just a system.
Right.
And it becomes very inconvenient when they start to realize that they got the wrong guy, but they've already put the work in.
Yeah.
But it's weird that, and I know it's got to be weird from your perspective, because you were in for what, 17 years?
Correct.
Right. So how they could just so callously literally throw somebody's life away because you're missing out on, I mean, 17 years. And you know, arguably, those could be the best 17 years of your life.
Arguably. I mean, taking consideration, I walked out of the prison at the age of 37. I walked into the institution at the age of 19. So you're right. My young adult life was the time for me to have kids. 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26... I think for the woman, it cuts it off at 28, 29, says something about the eggs. I don't know. I don't know if they're true or not. But at some point or another, you have to realize and appreciate the fact that those same dilemmas plague the man, too. His count drops. And it drops even more drastically because he's been affected by an institution who's poisoning him. You got to take that in mind. You have some of the most healthiest specimens that walk into institutions and come out riddled with diseases and plague with things, in other words, they can't get rid of. Why? Because the medical program that they have inside is designed to do just that, break their body down. And so they don't get the health care in which the great public think that they're getting.
And that the public is paying for.
Yeah,
right?
But it's a business. Just keep that in mind. In other words, keep that in mind that the public is paying for, right? So the public is contributing funds to this institution to take care of medically, mentally, these individuals who have been incarcerated. But nevertheless, those things are not happening. They're passing out Thorazine and Cinequans as though it's Halloween and it was candy for trick-or-treat. And we know that Thorazine is a medication that they use to lobotomize people.
Yeah, and we had Jason Baldwin on the show, and he was talking about the Thorazine shuffle and how he was avoiding that being placed in that situation at all costs, even at his own extreme risk to his own personal safety, because they offered to put him in there for his own protection. He said, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Reason why is because he recognized that was part of the mechanisms, in other words, to destroy his body so his spirit wouldn't have the strength to fight to get out. You got to fight to get your body right, and then you fight for everything else.
Let me go back to this, Obi, because it's always incredible to me, the spirit of the people that are in this building right now, right? And you're one of 200 men and women who've been through these unbelievable ordeals. How did you find the strength to continue to fight? I mean, you're just a young guy, a young black guy in a system that's full of young black guys, right? And I know you're focused on that and the disparity between how the justice system treats white people and minorities, right? And it's an American shame, but
it's an American tradition and it's an American pleasure. It's a shame for those individuals who has to suffer. But for those individuals who inflict that suffering, it's a pleasure and a desire.
So, I hate to think of it that way.
I know what they're doing, and that's what they've been doing.
Yeah,
it's not as though the rest of the people are somehow or another are naive or ignorant about those things. They just try to fight against what they're doing versus creating the situations to stop what they're doing. Two totally different kind of thinking.
And it's crazy because we know that in the rest of the civilized world, Western Europe and places like that, they treat incarceration as rehabilitation.
Amazing.
We treat it here as punishment. It just doesn't make any sense. You know, I often say, like when I'm with a politician or somebody like that I'm talking to about these issues, I say, if another country treated our citizens the way we treat our citizens, we'd invade them.
Yeah.
We'd be like, listen, motherfuckers, we're coming in. We got tanks. We got planes.
No. They are. So take in consideration, they are invading us. They are doing it. So right now in the local, the police department, they got tanks. In the local, the police department, they do all of those things. So they are raiding us. However, but who are they raiding? They are raiding the inner city. And they're raiding the inner city for black bodies and bodies of color, and they put them in prison for long periods of time. They're doing it.
It's a war on the poor. There's no question. But let's go back to that, because I think anyone would say, if I was in that situation that you found yourself in, not even like 15 to life, 20, like life, natural life, you're sentenced to life. Society said, here's what, you're going to die in prison.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. Nobody cares about you. You're gone, right? And you have no resources at your disposal. It's not like you have a rich uncle who's like, I'm going to hire the best, go get, you know, whoever it is, the top defense attorneys. Right. I'm going to get a squad out there. You know, you don't have money to hire a private investigator to uncover this. And I'm going to say a nice word, malfeasance, this corruption, this
correct,
you know, this frame job that was perpetrated on you.
Right.
So where did you find the strength to say, I'm not going to give up. I'm going to find a way out of what is an impossible situation?
I gave up on myself.
You gave up on yourself? What do you mean?
I gave up on myself and I relied on the Creator.
So you found faith?
Wasn't found faith. Didn't have to find it. I just had to give up the you that everyone else has seen and enjoy the you that was always been in me. And that gave me the power to see hope so that I can go towards it. If you don't know what's going on in here, you ain't tripping on nothing else. You too busy concerned about the attachments that's around you.
So how did you find it? When did you find it? Like, you didn't go in as a man of religion, right?
No, absolutely. I found it when the judge called me down. When they called me down to the county jail, I was sitting in the county jail facing life without the possibility of parole. It was during that time because they called me down to the county and they told me that I was being charged with a murder, three attempted murders with three attempted robberies with special circs. I'm like, what in the world is that? I'm like, are you sure you got the right CDC booking number right there? I mean, like, my last three is 676. Is that 676? He said, yeah. So I found it the day the judge told me, because I was facing the death penalty initially, that I was facing the death penalty. And I'm like, and I know that I didn't do it. and I'm facing a death penalty on this side of the gate, and on this side of the gate, I'm looking at life without the possibility of parole. So I didn't find anything. That stuff kind of sport. It just, you know, that's that. I think that's what them Buddhas do in them Zen when they go in that thing and they sit in that cave for a little while and they trying to find some kind of enlightenment and they get that boom. Sometimes people happen, they get that boom when they get traumatized because they get hit by a car, they're in an accident. They get that boom. They see the light. Well, I did get hit by a Mack truck. Didn't hit me physically, but as you see today, it wrecked me on the inside. Crushed every inch of my spirit. But I rebuilt it though, so.
You didn't. It's amazing to see you because honestly, and again, we're here in person. You're out there listening to his voice, but just running into you in the hallways here and stuff. I mean, you got a smile that lights up the room. Obi's here with his wife who looks like a movie star. You know what I mean? And like, it's
thank you.
Yeah. I mean, so somehow or other, you did prevail. Ultimately, yes. Your conviction was overturned.
Correct.
Justice was finally done. Correct. 17 years later. You walked out into society a free man, but you still had to rebuild. How did you get from that to this where you look like I mean, you look like you're ready to...
Oh, man, thank you, man. Thank you. I appreciate it. I got right there because, again, it's about perception and how you see things, the way I took it in. And the way that I took my exoneration in, it wasn't that justice had finally came and that it was done. No, it was just justice had just begun. And so I was born in that instance. And it gave me a sense of renewing. Like, man, I can do this, I can do that, and I can. Like, why am I upset with you about this crazy stuff over here when I got the opportunity to use that same energy to be happy and love and kind of, I can. You know, you figure in places like that, you don't waste your time on nonsense. Happy times now, happy times.
Yeah, you came out in 2011, about 5.5 years ago.
Yes.
And now you're here in San Diego. The future looks good. I mean, obviously, there's still the scars are not going to heal in 5 years. They're not going to heal in 15 years.
You're right.
But you're like extremely optimistic and energetic individual. Yeah. Anybody who bumps into you in the lobby is going to pick up on that. And it's inspiring to everybody that's here to see you up on stage last night dancing with other exonerees or whatever it might be.
Yeah, we have fun.
And it does, I hope you know that it has a real impact, not only on your peers, but also on all of those of us who are in the movement who come out of this meeting you and wanting to go do more and devote more time and more energy and more resources to fight this fight.
Right.
And fix this system so that the next Obi never has to go through what you went through. And now you're here as an example of what's possible. And
right.
If you could share what you've learned and what you want people to understand about you, what would it be?
It's a major difference in believing and knowing. Transition, that stage, is the life, the living is in a no. You live through the no. You survive through the opposite. You survive through that. You survive through your belief because it gets pushed upon constantly. So you survive and you have to tolerate and you do those things. But when you transition to the no, you live in it and you exercise the right of the fact of the no. And that's what I want people to take. I say all the time, I go around, I get a chance to talk at, you know, colleges and universities, and I speak at high schools, and I talk to kids, and first thing I say, what's 2 + 2? They say 4. I say, you know that, don't you? I say, yeah. I say, well, who do you believe in? They say this. I say, why? You just told me 2 + 2 = 4, so why are you believing this and not knowing it? You must know that which you say is yours. I can't say I believe in our marriage, in the sanctity of our marriage, and not know the person that I'm saying that I believe that. So I have to know. So it's a transition. And that's what I want people to walk away with is transition over to the know, exercise the right to believe, but say that my worth is better than that, and my know solidifies me, and I move forward towards my objectives, towards my accomplishments because of my know. My belief puts me in a want sort of scenario. It makes me want things because of what I believe. So take that.
So it's really the power of knowing, I guess, the power of knowing.
And that's why the innocents come home, because they knew they're innocent. They knew that they would come home. They didn't want to come home. So I want to go home. No, they say, I'm going home. I'm innocent.
That's a powerful message, and I think that we can all learn from that, and I'm going to have to really process it. It's interesting because I've never heard it phrased in that way. And, you know, I've listened and I've learned from so many incredible people, so many spiritual people who've been through ordeals like what you've been through, people from all walks of life. Yes. But I've never heard anybody put it that way. And I think that, like I said, I'm really glad that you shared that. So I'm glad you're here in San Diego. I'm glad to be here with you. It's a beautiful day.
Thank you. Can we get a shout out to Exonerated Nation?
Exonerated Nation, yeah. Is there anything else you want to plug your, any social media or any other projects that you're working on?
I mean, like, only project that I'm working on right now is Exonerated Nation. The other project is a personal project. personal project, but my public project is Exonerated Nation, and that's what I'm doing right now. So I just want to give a shout out to Exonerated Nation and all those potential or desired supporters.
And how do people, if they want to learn more about Exonerated Nation?
A couple of different ways. So I do have a website. It's called Exonerated Nation. You can look it up online. It's a website. I also have a Facebook page that you can also go on.
ExoneratedNation.com?
Yeah, .com. You can go on there. I employ people to follow and those things. But the only reason why I ask you to follow is because I need you to work. Your following with no actions doesn't help. I need, follow me so that we can dig this ground and submit in justice as it's supposed to. Your following is action. It's not a metaphorical situation to say, I'm following him. No, no. So what do you mean you're following him? All right, what kind of following? Are you stalking? Well, no, not that kind of following. Well, you need to describe. And when you describe your following, you want to describe a support. I'm doing this, I'm doing that. I'm doing this and I'm doing that.
But you got to first learn and get involved. And the good news is, I think we're, because of what's going on in this country right now and in the world, when what I call the new age of activism, I think there's more people than ever that want to get involved. They want to learn from people like you. They want to help prevent injustice and fight against this crazy situation that we find ourselves in, not just in the criminal justice system, but in general, and make this world a better place. And you're doing an incredible job. And I really appreciate you sharing your experience, strength, and hope with our listening audience. And I know it's going to have an impact on many of them. So I hope that makes you feel good, because it should.
And it does. And I thank you for the opportunity, and I really appreciate it.
Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. And I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause and helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.